please be seated. Morning. If it's Thursday, we're in Madison, back in Madison, after having been on the road yesterday in Portage, Columbia County. And we're delighted to have with us today the Wisconsin Career Academy. Would they please stand? Maybe we don't have them with us today. Well, if they come, we're going to be delighted to see them. We have here Globe University Paralegal Club. Would the members of the club please stand? Thank you very much for coming. We're delighted to have you. Does anyone else want to be recognized? Well, let me introduce the bench to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our first case today, and that is 10-AP-387-CR, State versus Gregory K. Nielsen. Arguing on behalf of Gregory K. Nielsen, although I'm not sure that's who we're arguing on behalf of, but is Joseph N., is it Amon? Amen. And Beth E. Hannon will be arguing for the State of Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Is the amicus going to argue today? And you will take 5 minutes from whose, Mr. Amon? So, Mr. Amon, you are going to be 20 minutes, 5 minutes. And counsel, who are you? State your name, please.
Your Honor, Thomas Ruse.
Pardon me?
Thomas Ruse, H-R-U-Z.
Okay.
Wisconsin State Bar Appellate Practice.
All right. Amicus. And then 30 minutes for you, Ms. Hannon. 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Joseph Eamon. I'm representing the Office of the State Public Defender. The Public Defender challenges the Court of Appeals decision in this case, and it's, by implication, it's an evolving practice in general, to impose monetary sanctions in its formal written opinions based upon its summary conclusion that a rule of appellate procedure has been violated. In this case, and in most of the other recent ones, it's the appendix content rule. The public defender believes that this practice violates due process. The public defender further believes that the appendix content rule, at least as it's been interpreted by the Court of Appeals, is unconstitutionally vague. And finally, the public defender believes there was no error in this case. The brief complied with the rule, and Mr. Nielsen's attorney certified accurately what she provided. Among the most basic founding principles of our form of government, our system of law, is that the government cannot deprive a person of liberty or property without due process. And due process means simply notice and an opportunity to be heard. There's a large body of law that interprets notice or defines notice as notice of the conduct or the rule which the government relies upon to justify its intended taking. And an opportunity to be heard requires a meaningful hearing before any such taking occurs, not before the taking, before a decision is made on the taking. The Court of Appeals now says no. Then in these cases, notice means simply notice that a rule or law exists and that the opportunity to be heard can occur after the fact, either on a motion to reconsider or an appeal to this court, as we are here. These are dangerous notions, and I believe there's no support for them anywhere in the law. In fact, the decisions the Court of Appeals relies on here careful reading shows they actually all support the public defender's position. In all of those cases, either there was greater process or the courts found a violation of due process. Despite the courts sort of trying to minimize this, there's actually a great deal at stake here. This court, going all the way back to its Eau Claire County decision from 1897, hit the mark squarely. That case says when the court perceives itself to be wronged, the court must take great care in addressing that wrong. This is true in part because the court's no longer a neutral or detached participant. The court perceives itself to the court as the accuser, the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury in these cases. And so when that occurs, it requires careful and complete process. More recently, far more recently, in the Anderson case, this court picked up on this. It said that notice is specific notice of the charge is required, a meaningful pre-judgment hearing is required, and the court must execute a specific detailed ruling. It must make a record, and all of those things are required for the record. And the failure to do so, court's failure to do so will lead to arbitrary application of the ruling or rulings, which is exactly what's happened here. If you put this case side by side with State versus Knox, it's a textbook example of an arbitrary application of the law. Same appellate court panel, exact same issue. Court in Knox arguably provided less than was provided here. There they found no error. Here they found error, imposed a fine, and essentially labeled the attorney a liar for providing a false certification.
Mr. Amon, for the moment, let me assume that I agree with your position, which I understand is that if the Court of Appeals wishes to sanction counsel for failure to comply with the rule relating to the appendix and or failure to comply with the certification, that is, it's a false certification, you think that a summary footnote just ordering payment is contrary to due process, right?
I do.
Failure to notify, failure to give an opportunity to be heard. Well, we got in June a communication from Ms. Hannon saying that there was a new footnote in a new case while this case was pending, which I should have to do for me. Okay. And it's in State versus Neal, correct? And that new footnote says that they have grave concerns about the counsel filed briefs to meet her obligation of candor, citing 20:3.3A1, which is not cited in this case, right?
No, but by implication it is.
Yes, and it's cited in other cases, right? And that the attorney there have mischaracterized, according to the Court of Appeals, some matters. And the omission hampered their efforts, they said, to assess the complaint. And they went on to say that they directed the lawyer to pay within 30 days $100. To the clerk of court. And then they went on, citing Bonds, which is a key case often cited, and citing 809-83-2. And then they go say, counsel may alternatively, this is the pay $100 sanction. Oh, I'm sorry, that they can show cause. I forgot to read that. Because of Neil's pro se circuit court submission, a key, the attorney shall within 30 days of the opinion show cause to this court, that's the Court of Appeals, in writing, why not to pay $100 to the clerk as a sanction for filing a false certification. That's the issue here, too. Mm-hmm. And then it says, well, if you don't want to show cause, you can pay the $100. It's like a traffic ticket. You can pay the $100, right? Or you can come to court and show why you shouldn't pay the $100.
Well,
is this going to satisfy you?
No. It's still a prejudgment. The court has reached a conclusion on the merits and imposed a fine. And says you can challenge this in an alternative way. You can. It's essentially a motion to reconsider. And that's not good enough. It's
okay.
Prejudged.
If it were reworded and said, in order to show cause why a sanction should not be, a $100 sanction should not be imposed.
I think what this court did just last week is the way to go. I'm sorry, I just got this. I've not provided it, but you guys are aware of it, and I'll hand this to Attorney Hannon. But it's in the, it came out on the 29th, and it's ordered that the attorney shall show cause in writing why this shouldn't happen. We believe that a violation may have occurred, and you get to contest it before we reach a conclusion. And you can put the amount in or not, that doesn't matter, but the what's critical is that you get an opportunity before the judge makes a conclusion, or the court makes a conclusion that an error has occurred, you get to challenge it. You get your say before they say, yes, there's been an error.
Because you think it's an uphill fight once the court has made that determination.
Absolutely, particularly when it's been made publicly in writing, and the damage is already done. You can't unring the bell. I mean, regardless of what this court rules in this case, this decision of Nielsen's out there. This attorney's, I think, has unfairly been labeled, you know, a liar, and a fine has been imposed. And we can save the fine, but we can't unring that bell. And what's more, it's problematic that it's in the decision because it puts the client and the attorney at odds, you know, not just in terms of how they're getting along, which often you know, isn't well in public defender cases, but it puts us at procedural odds. What if in Nielsen, lightning had struck and the court reversed on a Galeon issue, and lightning struck again and the state didn't appeal? Nielsen wants his resentencing, but the lawyer disagrees with the ruling on the sanctions and wants to appeal. Here we are, you know, came down last December that the defendant in this case would be waiting 9 months for resentencing. No, of course not. He'll order his attorney not to file this. This should be taken out through an order to show cause. It's a fight between the lawyer and the court, not the client or the court or the case.
Counselor, did anybody move for reconsideration here?
No.
So the lawyer got this in the footnote that he was going to be sanctioned, and he just let it go by. Didn't try to explain.
Just let it go by. I mean,
Well, there wasn't a motion for reconsideration where there was an attempt to show the Court of Appeals that the rule was not violated.
That's correct. And she wasn't required to do that. She could choose to address it through an appeal or a writ, which is what we've done here.
Okay. But what – all right. That I just wanted to be sure I understood the facts.
Yeah. No, I don't believe reconsideration is required. And part of it is we want to get a ruling.
Not whether it was required. Whether it was done.
Correct.
Just wanted to get the facts straight. Thank
correct.
You.
Do you have any figures as to how often something like this occurs?
I don't have precise statistics, but I provided a long string of cases in my appendix. I think something like 17 in the most recent year. Since Bonds was decided, there was a trickle, and it's increasing exponentially.
Does it only happen against the public defender's office, or is this something that happens to private counsel as well?
It's most frequently criminal cases, and those are most often public defender, but it's happened to private attorneys as well, and in one case it happened to the Justice Department even.
The state was had a similar sanction.
In one case, yes.
In one case. Yeah. Part of your argument seems to be, or maybe I misunderstood it, that you as defense counsel have obligations, as all counsel, to defend your client with zeal. And that defending with zeal doesn't include putting in your appendix matters that are contrary to you or contrary to your defense.
Maybe arguably contrary, right? I think arguably, that's something that is contrary, yeah, we do have to provide.
Is that your argument?
Not exactly. You're right. We're a partisan advocate. And I look at the rule, and what the rule says is I have to provide a short list of things that are pretty concrete. But then it says I have to provide limited portions of the record.
Okay, limited. Let's look at exactly what you're supposed to do. Limited portions of the record.
Limited portions, not entire portions of the record. And then only those limited portions that are essential to, not merely relevant to, but are essential to, an understanding of the issues raised, an understanding of, not full resolution of, not anything. It's not requiring me to provide everything to decide the case, because oftentimes, like here, the issue is something didn't occur. And so I'm saying it didn't occur. The only way to conclusively prove that is to give you the whole record, and nobody wants that.
And how many pages of the sentencing were involved here or could have been involved?
Yeah, you know, I don't recall. I don't have the record with me. The sentencing transcript was, you know, in some cases, there are hundreds of pages of long. This wasn't that.
No,
this
but it seemed to have been 40-plus pages.
Yeah, it was not short. This was not a 10-page sentencing. And keep in mind here that the issue in this case was Galleon. And, you know, this simplifies it a little bit, but in Galleon, this court said, you know, a laundry list of characteristics plus a number isn't good enough. We need, when the number is announced, we need reasons. Why this number? And so what's relevant is, or what is essential to understand the issue, the other stuff may be relevant, but what's essential to understand the issue, which is what the rule requires, is this page where the court announced the number and didn't provide a justification for the number.
Well, but as I understand the argument of the Court of Appeals, your office, the office, put in a summary of the goals of sentencing, capacitation, protection, et cetera, but did not put in those pages that show that the court considered other aspects of the defendant, age, ability to understand, prior record, et cetera.
All those things were referenced in the brief, were all contained in the body of the brief, just those.
But not the appendix. So you had reference pages to the record, which
correct.
The court doesn't have when it's reading the briefs and alone.
Well, it can choose to not. It can choose to have it, too. We've provided it to the court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, here we've got the record. And I'm not so sure if it's the whole record in this case or not. So it could be boxes that you have to pour through. Mm-hmm. And it's not part of your appendix.
But keep in mind, we didn't raise excessive sentence here. Galleon is a very narrow issue. It says the court, when it announces its number, needs to justify it. And it didn't here.
Should this rule be changed to make it more or less vague? I mean, one of your arguments is vague. Should it be that limited portions of the record essential, and then not to understand the issues, but to resolve the issues, to decide the issues?
I think if you do that, I think we have to provide the whole record to the court in just about every case where we're alleging something didn't occur. And that's almost all guilty plea cases and frequently sentencing cases. And I don't think anybody wants that. Look, we want a rule that works. We're not trying to hide anything. But this is a judgment call. You know, we spend a lot of time now and always have spent time trying to figure out, you know, what we have to provide to comply with the rule. But I think this aspect is just has to be left to the attorney's professional judgment. And what they certify is what they believe. It's their belief, not the court's subjective belief, that they're certifying. I can't know what you want. I can't certify what you want.
Counselor, when this rule was added, the certification, I think it was probably in about 2005, and it went through the Judicial Council. Did the Public Defender's Office come and say the rule was vague or unworkable or give input?
Probably. Like, how it's been interpreted. I think this rule could be interpreted in a way that make that, that's constitutionally fine. I think you could say that the concrete aspects of the rule that the court in Bonds, you know, paradoxically says are meaningless.
The answer to my question is no.
No, correct.
The public defender did not come forward and complain about the wording of the rule.
And I have no complaint about the wording of the rule. It's how it's been interpreted. It's what's happened afterwards. Rule's fine if it just is interpreted in a way.
Well, I thought you were telling us it was unconstitutionally vague. I misunderstand.
As interpreted, it's unconstitutionally vague. But I believe it can be interpreted, and I hope I'm asking this court to interpret it in a way that, that clarifies it. And this particular aspect, this subjective, highly subjective component of it, I don't think lends itself very well to the sanction thing. Because, again, it's the attorney making a professional judgment, making a call about what they think is essential to understand the issue. And I believe we provided that. And, you know, in other contexts, like ineffective assistance of counsel, we defer to counsel's judgment, professional judgment. And I think the court needs to and should do that here as well.
Counselor, given the thousands of cases that proceed through the Court of Appeals and the minuscule number of sanctions that have been given since, 2005, it strikes me as a tough argument that you're making that people don't understand how the rule is supposed to be applied.
It's the number's not minuscule, it's growing, and I'm telling you I don't understand.
Pretty small
I can tell
to
you,
me, there was only one in 2005, there were four in 2006, there were four in 2010, and you know, I look at the chart that was provided, and given the thousands of appeals, I have a hard time understanding that the rule is not understandable to the practicing bar.
Well, I've given you a list of scenarios in this case. What does the rule require? Does it require the whole sentencing transcript? I can't find language in this rule that says I have to. And it says limited portions. Courts that have provided CLE programs have said they don't want large portions. They want...
But, you know, if you're talking about a galleon sentencing, mm-hmm. Justice Bradley very carefully drafted for the court exactly what is required. So when you read Galleon, and you are the person who was there saying the trial court didn't do it right, my goodness, just good advocacy would support the premise that you should give the court what it needs to make a decision in your favor. So if you're saying Galleon wasn't complied with, how can you give the Court of Appeals less than they need to thoroughly review the claim you're making?
Because this rule requires me to provide what's essential to understand the issue, not more. Nothing more than that. And you can't take property from me when I've done that without an opportunity for me to justify it. And then how does this attorney square this with what the court did in Noss? Found no error. The court and was provided less. They addressed the issue in Noss, found no error.
Well, I think the court can often go about looking for things. We look for things all the time. And just because it's in the brief, I'm sure the other justices do, I know I have my clerk check the facts back in the record to see if the brief is accurate, because we don't want to make a decision based on facts that were somehow not quite what we wanted or what the record shows. So... Well, thank you.
May I ask?
Justice Prosser.
Irrespective of how this case is decided today, should this court be looking at any rewording of the rule?
Yes, I think there could be a better rule. I don't think you can. I think some judges on the Court of Appeals, and maybe some of you too, want to untether the brief and the argument from the record. I don't think you can ever accomplish that unless you require us to provide the whole record, which is wasteful and costly, and I hope you don't do that. One thing you could do is put a burden on opposing counsel to, if they think there's something in the record that is helps understand the case from their point of view, require that they provide it. I believe that may be required in the federal rules, but there could be a better rule.
Well, federal rules, as I understand them, require a joint appendix.
Yeah.
And So, and that came to us at one of these hearings on Chapter 809 on appellate rules, and we decided not, for some reason I cannot remember, decided not to adopt that. But each side can put in an appendix.
Right, but the requirement falls on the appellant, and
I understand
that. And that's where the fine occurs.
So maybe the rule has to be modified to put it on both, or not understand the issues, but to decide the issues. Maybe that would help.
Yeah, well, I think decide the issue is problematic because I think you get the whole record then. And if you want that, I guess we can do it. But like I said, it's expensive and wasteful.
Okay, counsel, thank you. Amicus.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas Ruse. May it please the Court. I have the privilege of appearing on behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin Appellate Practice Section and its members. The issues before the Court are of great interest to our members for obvious reasons, and we appreciate the opportunity to be heard on this. And in that regard, I'd like to thank the Office of the State Public Defender for ceding some of its time today. The section outlined, we think, pretty clearly the fundamental position that we're taking in our brief. It's simple, basic, but we think very important. And it is important to recognize it's not just a matter that is, although the occasions have been more frequently in the domain of criminal practice, this is an issue of keen interest to civil practitioners like myself. I can speak from personal experience and from other anecdotes. We take great consideration in how to apply the appendix rule and do it correctly, and sometimes there are judgment calls to be made. What we think is ultimately the most important thing is that if the Court of Appeals believes that a violation has occurred, we're not saying that it can't enforce the rules in the least. We believe there's great value in the Court enforcing the rules that inure to the benefit of practitioners. We just ask that if there is reason to believe a rules violation has occurred, that the Court afford an opportunity for the party to be notified that it believes that a violation has occurred, and then some form of basic response to be allowed of the alleged party.
What about the order to show cause if you don't want to pay what's already been ordered, the Neal decision that I read?
I think the section would say it's an improvement, although I think we agree that there still is a benefit to first articulating that we believe there might be a violation and then allowing the opportunity to be heard, and then that conclusion being reached by the Court after that opportunity. Again, it's an improvement, but I think in this domain we can do better in terms of the process. And we don't think it's too onerous in the least, but has great benefit. And we believe there's a prudential value that we outlined in our brief I'll not get into, but that the dialogue between the Court and the party can enable the Court to make a more reasoned decision. But ultimately, when we hear from our members, there is just the basic notion of fairness. And I echo the point that in this instance, the aggrieved party here is the Court. And the Court has both the responsibility of enforcing its rules, but also doing it in a manner that gives due process. And we think that in that context, it's especially important for the Court of Appeals to allow some pre-deprivation opportunity to be heard.
So you're saying that the victim is deciding whether they're victimized and then the punishment for being the victim?
Correct, without first hearing out the party that allegedly did the wrong. And
you're not suggesting we have another court make the decision, though?
No, we're not suggesting.
You don't view this like contempt?
No. I mean, there's ultimately always a ability for further review, but not in the first instance, no.
There's no attack on the power of the court to impose a sanction for violation of a rule of the court?
Certainly not, no.
As long as you've got notice and have an opportunity to be heard.
Correct, Your Honor.
Counselor, why doesn't the statute provide you the notice in the same way that if I'm driving my car and I'm driving 45 miles an hour, but there is a posted speed limit of 30 miles an hour, I'm given notice of what I'm expected to do? Why doesn't the statute give you the same notice?
I think the statute gives you some form of notice as to what's required, and I do believe there's reasonable – I do agree with the Public Defender's Office that there, on the margins, are differences of opinion as to how to apply the appendix rule. And I know personally I've had occasions to think about that. The key here is that, especially in that context of a rule of this nature, that, yes, there is the notice, this is required of you, you should comply with the rules, but sometimes we think that there is a decision made that you are complying with the rule in good faith. And, you know, to use your example, there might be an instance in which a party's brakes go out on their car, and so they're out of control. And even in the speeding ticket context, you know, regardless of what the fine might be, my understanding is that every individual that's charged with an offense does get that opportunity to appear before a judge.
Well, and there is a motion for reconsideration. I mean, if you believe that you'd complied with the rule and you made a motion for reconsideration and you told the Court of Appeals, you know, I object to your conclusion and this is what I did and this is why I did it, you would have an opportunity to be heard at that particular time, just like you do when you have a reason why you shouldn't be charged with speeding in that instance.
I understand the point. I would submit a couple things besides what the parties have briefed in terms of the idea that after the fact having the opportunity to be heard. I think 80924 is certainly not designed for this type of idea of reconsideration. I mean, certainly the Judicial Council note suggests it should be used rarely, and it's really a matter of there was something fundamental about the merits of the decision that was completely overlooked, maybe unknown to the court, and therefore there's the motion. And there's even a limited opportunity to be heard in that sense. You have the motion, but no necessary right to have a brief in support of it, although you can make your arguments in the motion. The other part of it is that, in our mind, is that, you know, again, as a prudential matter, there's not much harm in requiring a process that we're advocating, as opposed to just a motion for reconsideration.
Well, if you consider that the Court of Appeals has unending time, there's not much of a problem. But, you know, we have a Supreme Court case that goes all the way back to 1968 when this court was the final, was the appeals court and the final court as it is today. And it's a sanctions case, and the rule there was not much different than the one we have here. And there was a sanction for failing to comply with that rule by this court. And what we said is, you know, the purpose of the rule is to enable us, in the limited time available, to give due consideration to all the cases presented to us. And, you know, the Court of Appeals is a very high-volume court, as I'm sure you are aware. And, you know, if they had unending time, I would agree with you that your rule wouldn't be problematic. But they don't have unending time.
Right. And I would submit in that regard that if a party, such as in this case, feels that the sanction is unwarranted, you're going to get to that position anyway, whether it's a motion for reconsideration or where we are today, which is burdening this court's time, too.
Right. But I would bet that there are a number of lawyers that sign the certification without actually reviewing what they're doing in the appendix. It's kind of those things like shutting your garage door with your clicker, and then you wonder, gee, did I shut it when you're a block down the street? Because you don't really think through what you're doing. And the certification is meant to be an ability for the lawyer to check, did you comply with the rule? That's what the certification is about. And if you would take the time to check before you sign the certification, I would bet that you would have more compliance, although I think compliance is really quite good at this point, given the statistics I have. So, you know, I have some concerns about adding another procedure that the Court of Appeals is now required to do, rather than keeping the burden on the attorney, which is where the statute currently places it.
No, and I understand your point, Your Honor. And we're not looking to burden the Court of Appeals. We're just looking to ensure that in those instances in which there is an alleged violation and the intent further to impose a sanction, that just a minimal opportunity. We're not requiring a full-blown evidentiary hearing or anything of that nature. We would just like some notice and opportunity to show cause. But we understand there is a burden. See, my time
you're
is
just
up.
Trying to help the Court of Appeals, because otherwise they have the burden by themselves.
Correct, Your Honor. And it's and to practitioners, because, you know, I know personally what I do and other people what I practice with, we do take great effort in complying with the rule. But I can envision scenarios, and it depends on the level of rigor by which the court wants to enforce, you know, decisions on the margin, where there could be in this case, at least represents an instance in which one party thoroughly believes that there was not a violation here and wanted the opportunity before the sanction was articulated to express that. So,
may I? If we were to accept your position in this case, are there other situations where the Court of Appeals imposes a sanction that it's all right not to have an order to show cause?
We did consider this, and our notion, and this is consistent with the Seventh Circuit's practice, is still to provide notice and opportunity of any alleged rule violation. And it might seem that in certain instances the violation or non-violation is more keen because of the nature of the rule and the subjectivity that might be applied to it. But we would submit that there are at least conceivable reasons why there might be a defensible basis for what might otherwise appear to be a manifest violation of the rules. And again, we would commend to the Court, you know, the Seventh Circuit's practice in this regard, even to the extent of allowing notice and opportunity to be heard on things as objective, seemingly objective, as page limits and word limits of briefs. It's going to be no consolation to an attorney who just blatantly violates the rules, even of something direct, to have to then face the music in that regard. But again, it should be commensurate with the notion of what's been violated. If it is a more ministerial violation, all we think the Court needs to do is say there's a violation here. You have X number of pages to explain why you did so. And if there's no good explanation, it won't take very long to dismiss that explanation, even on a more seemingly less subjective rule violation, if you will.
So what you're really saying here, Mr. Ruse, is that a decision in your favor here will have application beyond the appendix content rule.
Yes. Yes, that is. I mean, that would be our position. We know the issue might not be before the Court, but as amicus party, that is our position.
Any other penalties except for certification and the appendix? Have there been any other penalties except for this false certification and that the appendix is not complete?
Have there been, by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals? Yes, there have been instances in which, as I understand it, there have been page limitations, not citing properly to the record, as the rules require. Those have been occasioned or have sanctions imposed.
But this is the most frequent of the infrequents?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Beth Hannon, representing the State of Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Ms. Hannon.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Beth Ermatinger Hannon, speaking today on behalf of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. The rules that are being challenged today are rules that this Court approved. They essentially function as tools. The content rule is a rule this Court approved at the time of formation of the Court of Appeals. Some years after that, as the workload of the Court of Appeals continued to expand, the problem of noncompliance with the content rule came to be addressed, and in 2005, this Court approved the certification rule. It was meant to foster increased compliance with the content rule and improve the quality of appendices filed with appellate courts. It does appear, by virtue of the statistics we've already been discussing today, that those tools, those rules, work quite well. A very small fraction of the number of appeals that the Court of Appeals handles which require appendices, and admittedly not all of them do, out of 3,000 annually, maybe 1,000 do. That seems to be empirical evidence that the rules are working and that they're understood.
Well, how do we know that the Court of Appeals is consistent checking the appendices in each of the 1,000 cases to make sure they comply with the rule and assessing a fine if they don't? In fact, don't we have evidence that they don't always do that?
There is evidence that they will at times, Your Honor, identify noncompliance, but explain why they are only alerting that fact and not imposing a monetary sanction. But it is, yes.
In every single one of the 1,000-plus cases in which an appendix might be required, the Court of Appeals checks to see whether it's in their determination that the appendix is okay.
In the state system, it is the judges who read the briefs.
I understand that.
And, which is different in the Seventh Circuit, where briefs and appendices can be rejected at the outset of an appeal.
Well, we can reject it. The clerk of the Supreme Court and the clerk of the Court of Appeals rejects briefs with some consistency if they don't comply.
I agree that that happens and that that authority is there, Your Honor. I don't know if it happens as often for the content rule requirements. Mm-hmm. But to answer your original question, we don't have data on how many instances of noncompliance are not articulated in an opinion. That being said...
That's right. That was my question.
Okay. Here, in the Nielsen case, the challenge was only to sentencing, and the content rule would require submission of the full decision that's being appealed. The rule certainly includes, as Mr. Eamon read, portions of the record essential to an understanding of the issues, and then it gets more specific. Including oral or written rulings or decisions showing the circuit court's reasoning.
And here, was there a written decision showing the reasoning or just a judgment of the final decision on sentencing?
The decision on sentencing was made in open court.
So it was oral.
Right, portions of the transcript. As this court said in 1974 in Commercial Discount, the reasons given by a circuit court in a ruling from the bench are part of its decision. Mm-hmm. So those reasons, and Justice Abrahamson, you had asked about pages.
Right.
Pages 166 through 212 of the public defender's appendix include the entire transcript. That's the appendix to this court.
Right.
The pages that include, that were included by Attorney Lee, are three of those pages, 206
through 208. That total is the 46 that I was referring to.
The 166 to 212, yes.
Yes, it's 46.
Right, that's the entire transcript, right.
And how much of that should have been in the Court of Appeals decision? Appendix, I'm sorry.
Right. There is initially, there is some testimony by witnesses. Once the witnesses conclude, starting at page 201, is when the court, Judge Flancher, starts to speak and announce her decision. So that would take 201 through 205, at least, pages that were not included in Ms. Lee's appendix.
So you would have 11 more pages?
I think at least 5 more pages.
Well, they gave 3, so 11, so maybe we're disputing 3.
Okay. But it's appellate courts have understood the reasoning is part of the decision. The rule specifically requires that the decision be included. The decision that's being appealed, and certainly if there are multiple issues before the trial, but a limited number of those are being appealed, that is what the appendix content rule is asking for. It's the Court of Appeals' position that what the public defender and perhaps the appellate practice section request is something that already exists. The show cause procedure that the Seventh Circuit uses is very much the same to the opportunity to file a motion for reconsideration. If we look at some of the show cause language in cases cited by the appellate practice section, for instance, the Abner case, the court identifies a violation of an appendix rule, a violation of a certification, and says the practitioner has X amount of days to show cause why a fine of $500, $1,000 should not be imposed.
Counsel?
Yes.
I received the July correspondence from you, and I have it someplace in front of me. It says, and I'm looking at the attachment, which has, in the case of State of Wisconsin versus Kenneth Neal.
Yes.
And in relevant part, the chief read a bit about the order to show cause. I want to throw in a little more language and see if you find it objectionable, okay? And what I'm throwing in is, in addition, the order to show cause why you shouldn't be found in violation. Okay. So it says here, because Neal's pro se circuit court submission and his post-conviction motions are plainly key to Neal's claims on appeal. Now I get to it. We direct that attorney Miller Carter shall, within 30 days of the date of this opinion, show cause to this court in writing why, and I want to insert, a violation of 809.83.2 should not be found, and picking up the language, why she should not pay $100 to the clerk of this court as a sanction for the filing of a false certification. Why not throw in that, if you will, prejudgment of a violation there, to give an opportunity to be heard as to whether or not there was even a violation?
I should have said at the outset, and I'm certain that I said in our brief, that, of course, if this court chooses to amend the content rule, the certification rule, the Court of Appeals is going to abide by that. I think I'm here to tell you the experience of the Court of Appeals and to discuss current procedure as it exists.
And I understand that.
Yes.
But I think my question is not with regard to changing the certification rule or the content rule, at least this question isn't, but rather the order to show cause procedure. Why not have the order to show cause pre-judgment of a violation rather than automatic judgment of violation and only order to show cause why you shouldn't be sanctioned for it?
I think the two are not that different. That said, there's no objection from the Court of Appeals to add that kind of language. But because there is an opportunity pre-deprivation, before the check is written, to file a motion for reconsideration, there is that opportunity to challenge, and the court could decide to amend that portion of its decision.
And that's different than the traffic ticket, which is a third party saying there's probable cause to issue this. And I shouldn't use probable cause, but in effect, this is what I think, says the police officer. You know, I was looking at this order in Nielsen, and it's an order. You've got signed opinions by the Court of Appeals, right? You've got per curiams, right? And you got orders.
Yes.
And it's my understanding, but maybe you can tell me better, that these orders are probably drafted by staff attorneys, aren't they? Under the supervision, or at least then the approval of the panel?
I believe some of them are, Your Honor.
And the staff attorneys, most of them are in Madison, right? Yeah, each district has one,
sure.
As I understand it. There may be more that's in the district, but they're in. And where's the record?
The hard copy record is in Madison.
Exactly.
Right.
So, in this particular case, the record is probably sitting on that staff attorney's desk, or easily accessible. that doesn't excuse a lawyer from making a full appendix, whatever full appendix means under the rule, and it doesn't excuse a lawyer from certifying it and doing accuracy in certification. But, and staff attorneys are busy too, and they are important for the work of the court, and the judge does have to review this, or judges have to review this. But there's something that doesn't quite fit right to me. I haven't quite put my finger on it yet.
I think that concept that the record is available, maybe down the hall, maybe on my desk, one of probably a number of them, was part of Dutcher, I believe, the case that Justice Rogensack referred to earlier in this argument. And even with that in mind, and let's say things are going electronic and they're going to be even more accessible, mm-hmm. I think the rules were created to deal with the volume so that we have a fair system of addressing all appeals in a continually growing volume.
So you don't have an objection to an order to show cause procedure, or the Court of Appeals does not, if that's what the court orders. And is it your position that that would increase the volume and problems for the Court of Appeals?
It's hard to say. I think we have to start with the premise one. There aren't that many violations, and we should all be happy about that. I think it means the rule is clear. Beyond that, we don't know. Perhaps more lawyers will take opportunity to respond, or perhaps not. Perhaps it'll be about the same amount as file motion for reconsideration when a sanction has been imposed, which started with the lawyer for Mr. Bonds back in 2007.
You know, I looked at the rule for reconsideration. Now I lost the reference to it. But it really
80924.
Thank you. It really is quite limited in what the lawyer can do, and quite limited in a variety of ways. And I'm less familiar with how it works than I am with the rule consideration, reconsideration here. But it's difficult. 80924. A party may file a motion for reconsideration within 20 days. That's fair enough. The motion must state with particularity the point of law or fact alleged to be erroneously decided in the decision and include supporting argument. No separate memorandum in support of the motion is permitted unless subsequently ordered by the court, and the court may order a response before issuing an amended decision. No response is permitted unless ordered by the court. The motion and any response, and who's going to give the response here, the court?
That's what happened in this case. But there may not be a response for this type of issue, certainly.
So it doesn't quite fit, is my point.
Well, I think it doesn't use the word reconsideration. It doesn't use the word sanction. It is fairly broad, though.
Yep.
The motion must state with particularity points of law or fact alleged to be erroneously decided. And so it's encompassing the entire decision. Now, I will acknowledge that the comment of the Judicial Council Committee,
right,
which I can't tell from here if it has been adopted or merely printed, but at times
they generally are printed but not adopted.
Yeah, and at times those comments are given persuasive value. That might seem to narrow it, but the rule itself is broader, and really the rule 80964, this court's reconsideration rule, is even broader.
Mm-hmm. But very narrow. You have to have something new. You have to have a fact error, law error, and the number of reconsiderations granted is less than the number of sanctions that Court of Appeals has imposed.
You're talking about the Supreme Court rule
yes.
on reconsideration. Right. I mean, the rule itself doesn't isn't so limiting. The internal operating procedures, I think, it put a little more meat on it. But the opportunity to file a motion for reconsideration because a sanction was identified has been done since Bonds and has occurred in a number of the cases, portions of which Mr. Eamon appended in his appendix. And there are a number of jurisdictions which say that reconsideration is sufficient for due process.
If this case came down and said that's your remedy, if you believe you've been inappropriately sanctioned for failure to comply with a rule, then certainly it would put everyone on notice, correct?
I think it would, and I think actually the pendency of this case has put people on notice. This is just anecdotally, but I haven't read an opinion other than we've discussed State v. Neal, which identifies an appendix sanction. I should make a point that our brief suggested that every time the Court of Appeals identifies a noncompliant appendix and says it wants to impose a modest monetary sanction, 30 days are afforded. I need to acknowledge that there were four cases in Mr. Eamon's appendix which had less than 30 days, and it's the position of the Court of Appeals that it should always be 30 days. That allows that 20-day window for reconsideration to have full effect.
An issue arose as to whether at the Judicial Council any objection from the Public Defender's Office was stated. Now, as I remember it, a public defender is on the Judicial Council. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. I also, again, this is not in the record such as we have for this case, but to Mr. Eamon's point that perhaps a rule should be modified so that the respondent should supply any missing parts of the appendix, that is something that a representative from the Attorney General's office voiced some opposition to, as that in a number of cases would fall to them to do that. And it probably defeats the purpose of certification that this court approved in 2005. So I think there would be some operational difficulties were the court to make that change.
Was that the objection to a joint appendix?
No, I think it was an objection to having any deficits in an appellant's appendix just be filled in by the respondent.
Could I ask you, there is certainly concern about monetary sanctions, but there appears also to be some concern about the effect on an attorney's reputation when a court of appeals, without any really any notice, says an attorney has falsely certified something. How would you correct that by a mere motion for reconsideration? It's in the opinion.
Well, there have been occasions from both the Court of Appeals and this court that if reconsideration is granted, or sometimes even if formally this court denies reconsideration, full case, but will withdraw some language, there can be a language modification in the original decision as a result of the lawyer submitting whatever he or she submits as an explanation for how their appendix appears.
But it's already in, and it's never taken out. It's just an additional memorandum or decision that says we withdraw the language, but the language is in the printed volume. So if this is in a printed form, it will show printed, and then there'll be something else, and may not even be in the same volume.
With all due respect, Chief, I don't believe that's correct. I think that the record, the opinions are regularly corrected, not for this particular thing that I'm aware of, But they are regularly corrected before they are finally printed in the hard volumes.
Not in the Supreme Court. And the motions that we see when the Court of Appeals issues a decision and then has a correction, it's shown, at least when we get it, as a correction. So we see the original with the, and then the correction.
Now, I was just speaking about the hard volume. I was not speaking about the initial opinion.
I think there are probably a couple of concerns at play in this discussion. One is just the use of the term false. Is that the right term to use, and should it stay there if some mitigating circumstances are shown on reconsideration? False seems to fit if, since 2005, the court has asked appellants to take the time to certify, to sign their name and say, it's all in there. The decision, including the reasoning, is in there. That isn't to say that the Court of Appeals wouldn't go along with some other terminology that this court sees fit to adopt. It's certainly terminology that the Seventh Circuit uses in its show cause orders. Show cause why this false certification and you shouldn't pay a fine of X dollars. So we're sort of in good company, but we stand ready to comply with what this court decides.
Counsel, much is made of the high, and well so, of the high volume of the Court of Appeals, and we don't want to add additional time-consuming procedures unnecessarily. Yet I do not understand the difference of time demand between a motion for reconsideration, which I assume the attorney will say, hey, I shouldn't have to pay the $100 because, and then it'll have some ameliorating effect on whether or not there was even a violation, or oftentimes will. What's wrong with this giving notice of an alleged violation before the finding is made? Doesn't seem, as I suggested in my prior question, it doesn't seem to me that the net effect is going to be any difference in time. But the net effect will be those who are your opposing counsel will say, oh, good, I have notice that there's an alleged violation before I'm found formally in violation. Well, there's some merit to that, I think. Time. Is there any difference in time?
I don't know that there has to be. I heard Mr. Eamon say that early in his argument that show cause wasn't going to be sufficient because there was some implication of being prejudged, although in the public defender's reply brief at page 3, it states that show cause would be suitable for most situations. So
I understood, and perhaps it's just a difference in understanding, that what I read from the Neal opinion wasn't sufficient, that order to show cause, because it already made a determination of violation without giving an opportunity to respond before that determination is made.
I think they may be two sides of the same coin, almost, to say the reconsideration opportunity is virtually the same as the show cause opportunity. To really undercut reconsideration could send the wrong message to other instances of reconsideration, suggesting it'll never be corrected, even if it should be, and I don't think the court wants to do that.
But theoretically and actually, the court does its best to state the facts correctly, state the law it's applying correctly, and reach a reasoned decision, right?
Sure.
But just like lawyers and everyone else, courts can make a mistake about the facts. courts can make a mistake about the application of the law, and there is an opportunity to reconsider, and courts, as you said, need not necessarily reconsider, but will make the correction. So there's a correction about the facts, there's a correction about the statement of the law, or some other matter that's done. So a motion for reconsideration is a good thing for the court and for the litigants. And that's why there's a motion for reconsideration in the Court of Appeals, because initially the court did not have that motion, was then doing motions sua sponte, or getting letters from lawyers who are familiar with the appellate practice. So instead of having all of this under the table, motion for reconsideration was done. The question here is that it's unlike the law and facts of the decision. Here is an extraneous matter, a separate matter relating to the lawyer, which has not been briefed, and on the substance we expected that was, not been briefed, and the court is making a decision without briefs, without hearing that matter, right? So having a motion for reconsideration for that, unlike a motion for reconsideration for substance and law, is different. And the question is, if you're going to have a motion for reconsideration, as I understand Justice Bradley, isn't that the same time as for the court as an order to show cause before the court makes a decision?
I think it could well be handled that way, Your Honor. And I think the bottom line of the Court of Appeals is it wants to handle things fairly, thinks it does. It requires respect for its procedural rules, as every court does. Whatever this court's determination might be, we ask that it preserve the deterrent effect and enable some reasonable enforcement mechanism for these rules. One option could have been a private letter to the lawyer. Don't have discussion in the substantive opinion, but send a letter and say, we think you violated the certification rule. Tell us why we haven't. Well, that sort of mechanism is not going to send the deterrent and enforcement message that I think this court recognized the Court of Appeals needs when it adopted the rule in 2005.
Well, I agree with that position. There does have to be a deterrent. And I haven't heard anything here, and I haven't heard it from the public defender, but we should ask him. I haven't heard that they're objecting to the rule. I haven't heard that they're objecting to a deterrent. They may be objecting that the office has the imposition of the cost, not the lawyer, but that's another issue which is not necessarily before us. I don't hear that. I hear that rule's okay. Court of Appeals may be right in saying the rule's been violated, or they may be wrong. All that they want, if I understand it, is an opportunity to be heard before a decision is made that the rule has been violated, and before a decision is made as to how much it should be, cost should be imposed.
They do want an opportunity to be heard, and the law provides pre-deprivation process. Allowing for reconsideration days or more than a week before any payment on the sanction would be due is process that is pre-deprivation. So whether the court sticks with reconsideration or adopts show cause, that sort of time frame should be enough. A couple other points I think was mentioned earlier, that there is no reference to an SCR violation in the Nielsen case, the case that we're here on. I realize the briefing talks more globally about those. But when the Court of Appeals does find that a certification of an appendix is is noncompliant and it assesses $100 or $150, that's for violation of the procedural rule. That's under 80983. That is not the Court of Appeals stepping into the role of OLR.
There's an OLR rule that requires that if you, that I don't know how often it is honored, that essentially says if you know of a violation of a rule of the Code of Ethics, that you report it to the OLR.
That's, I think, 60.04.3.
Thank you.
Applying to judges. But it has a little more detail in it, which I think answers the question of why these are not situations that the Court of Appeals perceives it's supposed to refer. There have been a few instances that we can find. Those are for egregious multiple infractions, but it has to be substantial, and it has to be evidence of the lawyer's dishonesty and essentially unsuitability to practice. And I don't think the Court of Appeals has ever said one non-compliant appendix rises to that level at all. And it doesn't sanction based on SCR. My time has been up, but unless there are other questions.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. Mr. Eamon?
Thank you. The speeding ticket model that Justice Rogensack mentions would give us more than we're asking for. It's been a long time since I've had a speeding ticket, since I think my boss is here. But when you get one, a government official says, this time, this place, this speed, you violated this law, you can contest it or you can pay. That'd be great, but we're not asking for that much. We want the specific charge. We want the opportunity to contest it before somebody makes a decision on it, and then we're all happy. And also, you made reference to attorneys just signing appendices. It doesn't happen in my the certification. Doesn't happen in my office. Doesn't happen to the attorneys I've talked to who've been sanctioned. I haven't talked to all of them, but a number of them. We take this very seriously. We try to comply. But these are judgment calls, and that's what really these things come down to. It's a disagreement over a judgment call. I also want to make the point that reconsideration isn't necessarily available to me. I represent a client in a case. I got to do what they want to do. And by putting these in the opinion, and it forces me to sometimes be at odds. Sometimes the client doesn't care, but if the client didn't want me to do it, I can't do it. So reconsideration isn't automatically available. But it's sort of beside the point, because all of the due process cases that we've talked about and that both parties have referenced talk about a pre-judgment, a pre-decision hearing. Before you've made up your mind, I want the opportunity to explain to you why I don't think you're right and why I don't think there was a violation. And reconsideration doesn't give us that.
Well, an order to show cause doesn't say that the court has decided that there's a problem or decided what the problem is, but it sure tells you the court is bothered.
Right.
And bothered may not equal a holding, but it comes awfully close. If the court orders, which our court periodically does, order to show cause why a more stringent sanction shouldn't be applied to a lawyer than the proposed 1 year, you know the court's got real concerns, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I know that you think this has happened, but you've not decided it. There's a big difference.
Well, I wonder how much.
Well, I hope it's a big difference. I'm trusting that it's a big difference. Getting back to the speeding ticket thing, this would be the equivalent of you getting a piece of mail from the government that says, you speeded, pay this. And that's it. That's sort of what's happening, what we get here. We need a specific charge and an opportunity again before the judgment is made.
Now, you're not asking for oral argument on the issue.
No, not at all.
You don't get that most of the time
on
the substance.
Although, you know, as the court says it hasn't imposed sanctions based on the candor to the tribunal, 23.3. I don't think, if you read some of these decisions, I don't think that's exactly right. They say, it says, and I provided them in my brief, they reference candor to the tribunal, and that seems to be the friction point. It starts with not providing what you want, but they frequently reference 3.3, and I do think those are OLR matters. I don't think that is where the court should go, because when you're talking about candor, that's fact-finding. There's more process that is required if you're going to go down that path. The problem isn't the word false. It's the reference to candor to the tribunal, the 23.3 thing. And this court has created a process for dealing with that, and it's OLR. And there's very thorough process.
So I understand you, Mr. Eamon. You're not saying, or I don't hear you saying, that the Court of Appeals cannot impose a sanction.
Not at all.
A violation of the rule relating to appendix. They can.
We are not
challenging. They think it's a violation of the rule of candor. They can apply the sanction anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not there's lawyer discipline, other than the costs, that belongs to a different body.
Correct.
But the Court of Appeals has the power.
Absolutely.
To enforce this rule.
We are not challenging your power to promulgate rules that fall within constitutional boundaries or the court's ability to enforce them and sanction, as long as it's done in compliance with the Constitution. An order to show cause is what we want.
Okay. Thank you. I want to thank Mr. Eamon and Ms. Hannon for their arguments today on relating to the issue of the constitutionality of the method by which the Court of Appeals has imposed a sanction for violation of the rules relating to appendix. Not an easy case. Argument well done by both sides, and thank you. That ends our hearing on 10AP387CR. State versus Gregory K. Nielsen. That ends our hearing on that. The court will take a few minutes recess so those in the courtroom who wish to leave may leave, and that other students who wish to come in will do so. We are in recess.